Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. There is a considerable wealth gap between black and white Americans. There has been ever since settlers landed on the continent. When slavery gave way to Reconstruction, some of those inequities might have been addressed, but efforts were soon squashed by the rise of Jim Crow and all that came with it. The corrections brought by the civil rights movement made some inroads, but not enough. And today, the wealth gap between white families and black families reaches about $1 million on average. And several local and state governments have sought to find ways to close that gap through various methods of reparations. Reparations are not merely a financial discussion. They represent an acknowledgement of past injustices and a commitment to rectify them as a step toward healing and equity. But the mere idea is tricky. In 2000, only 4% of white Americans supported reparations, as compared to 67% of black Americans. Just 3 years ago, in 2022, the needle moved, but not by much. 18% of white Americans support reparations at that time, and then compared to about 77% of black Americans, and one can only assume with the MAGA movement, those numbers have not changed for the better. Here to talk about the concept, the practicality, and the case being made for reparations is William Darity, the Samuel Du Bois Cook Distinguished Professor of Public Policy at Duke University. Kirsten Mullen is a writer, folklorist, museum consultant, and lecturer whose work focuses on race, art, history, and politics. And Reverend Dr. Benjamin Boswell is a nationally recognized preacher, pastor, author, educator, and social justice leader, and the creator and founder of Confronting Whiteness, a community of people striving to become anti-racist in their spheres of influence. Thank you all for being here. Welcome. Good morning. So, Dr. William Darity, I'm going to refer to you as Sandy with your permission. So, Sandy, you and Kirsten have worked on this and tag-teamed on this, these conversations for years together. You co-hosted the Arc of Justice podcast. You are the co-editors of the Black Reparations Project, a handbook for racial justice, and the authors of From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century. When you engage people in these conversations, how would you describe their attitudes toward the idea?
I think that most people that we engage in conversations about this are uncertain. I think that they are not as hostile as they once were, but I think that most of the questions we now get are concerned whether or not you can do this and how you might do it, rather than whether or not you should do it. And so we've actually been kind of pleased that the conversation has shifted to the level of logistics away from the level of merit. And so we think that that's an improvement in the conversation, but I think people have to be persuaded that we actually know how to do this. And that's been an important aspect of the work that Kirsten and I have done, is trying to actually design an appropriate or suitable reparations program for Black Americans whose ancestors were enslaved in the United States.
I think, Kirsten, the two of you did a podcast, about a six-episode podcast, in which you explored how today's racial economic inequality came to be. And we've discussed this many times on this program, so regular listeners might be familiar with why we are where we are. But for those who may not be or may not have been convinced, take us through it. Explain how it's possible that 160 years after the end of slavery, we have not been able to adjust economic disparities.
Absolutely, Mike. You know, so when you're talking about the post-slavery period, we're talking about national policies that produce the core economic setback, the racial wealth gap, which is the term that we use. So in the past 160 years, we've witnessed land policies from the late 19th century through the early 20th century that advantage white Americans and disadvantage blacks. So we're talking here about the Homestead Act of 1862. This was legislation that provided 160-acre land grants in the Western Territories to white families. Now, this is land that had just previously been occupied by Native people, Indigenous people, but also the GI Bill, which made it possible for many white veterans to purchase their first homes, their farms, businesses. And Black people, Black veterans were excluded, largely from these policies. Black GIs, many of them did get the education benefit. In fact, Sandy's father and mine both did receive the benefit of education through the GI Bill, but neither of them were able to buy a home or a business or a farm, right? So, they were not able to acquire an asset wealth in that same way. And then you have the 100 massacres that occurred between 1865 and the end of World War II. Now we're talking here about, a series of incidences launched by white supremacists across the country, in places like Arizona and Wilmington, North Carolina, but also Delaware and Bisbee, Arizona, some unlikely places, seemingly unlikely places. And so you're talking about white mobs enacting violence on Black communities and, importantly, Black business districts taking lives and destroying property, and in many instances, appropriating that Black property, right? So then when you look at homeownership policies, again, the GI Bill, but also redlining. I think many of your listeners may be aware of the decimation of Charlotte's Black Brooklyn district between 1960 and 1977. Here, Black-owned homes, businesses were taken through eminent domain to make way for interstate highways with the promise that the community would be rebuilt. But that never, happened. Bigger and better, right, was promise, but it was a promise that was not fulfilled. I mean, the federal highway system and slum clearance, urban renewal, or Negro removal, as some would say, really did a number, on Black communities. And so we use the summary measure of the racial wealth gap to set the minimal costs of a bill for Black reparations. The act of redress should bring the average wealth of Black households up to the level of their white counterparts. So at present, as you mentioned at the top of the show, the gap is $1.15 million per household, or roughly $400,000 per person. So the total amount required to eliminate the racial wealth gap in total would be about $16 trillion.
Which has gone up. It was 12, then it was 14, and now it
That's
is
right. The longer you
16.
wait.
Yeah, the faster it goes up. With all of that as backdrop, if you didn't know all of that, Ben, when most people think of reparations, when most white people think of reparations, they think of wrongs that began with slavery and maybe into Jim Crow, but they tend to think of that as black history. But from your point of view, it is white history, and you say white people are trapped in a history they don't understand, and until they understand it, they cannot be released from it. Talk about that.
Well, that wasn't really me who said that. That was James Baldwin, but I do
Oh,
believe
okay.
it. I'm just quoting from Baldwin there.
All right.
I think that it's really important for white folks to take this very seriously. We're trapped in a history of oppressing Black Americans that Kirsten and Sandy both describe: slavery, to segregation, to lynching, to redlining, to mass incarceration. It's left Black communities decimated and created this racial wealth gap, but it has also left white Americans, I believe, spiritually, morally, and emotionally deficient. And this is where reparations becomes a pathway for healing the spiritual, moral, and psychological wounds of white Americans and creating healthy communities that work for all of us.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the three of you, Ben, participated in something called Confronting Whiteness, a Confronting Whiteness Conference. I think it was about a year ago, and I'm curious how that went because Sandy mentioned that there's less of a pushback toward this today, less vitriol involved in the possibility of reparations. But curious how it went, who attended, how many attended, what their attitude coming into this event was, what their attitude going out of it was.
I was really impressed by the turnout. We had 250 people in attendance. And it was about half people of color and half folks who racialized as white. And Kirsten and Sandy were two of our speakers, but we also had other speakers come and talk about reparations from a theological perspective, from a philosophical perspective. And I thought the attendance was great. The questions were fantastic. People really were open-minded and curious. I think they came with a spirit of curiosity, wanting to try to understand. And I was really pleased, particularly here in Charlotte, in the South, in a place that has been a part of all the things that we've described of oppression and injustice toward Black Americans have been happening here in Charlotte, including urban renewal, which was previously mentioned. To have that turnout come at a church in Myers Park to have an open and curious conversation, I thought was really a good sign for our city.
I think anybody who knows anything about American history knows, Sandy, that African Americans or Africans were transported here hundreds of years ago against their will to become the property of other human beings. That practice ended, of course, with the Emancipation Proclamation at the end of the Civil War, with plans, as you have alluded to help these formerly enslaved folks get on their feet. The so-called 40 Acres and a Mule program, which we did a program about not too long ago. That promise was never fulfilled. It was withdrawn almost as soon as it was made. And then we went through 100 years or so of oppression from the end of Reconstruction to the Civil Rights Movement. Much of whatever has been changed for the better was accomplished through public policy, just as what happened that were bad, things that were bad, were accomplished through public policy. Do you believe that puts the onus on the leveling of the playing field on contemporary public policy? Can new policy address this further fully, or must there be monetary compensation involved as well?
So, first, I actually want to make a mild correction. I don't want to be too picky, but I don't think the Emancipation Proclamation effectively ended slavery in the United States.
Okay.
The Emancipation Proclamation declared the individuals held in bondage in the states in rebellion
Right.
free, but there were border states that were part of the Union where slavery was continued and was not declared ended by the Emancipation Proclamation. And of course, as long as the war continued, the slaves that were held bondage in the states of the Confederacy were not going to be free. So it's really actually the end of the Civil War and the adoption of the 13th Amendment that brings slavery to an end. That's a picky point, but
Thank
I
you.
thought it was important. And
Sure.
yeah, you mentioned what person, Juneteenth.
Well, I'm just saying this is why we have Juneteenth, because in Texas, the Confederates were able to hold forth and to prolong slavery until June 19th, 1865. So this is why we have this national holiday that celebrates the final end of enslavement, legal enslavement in the United States.
But I think in terms of the question of public policy, I think that the spirit of the Confederacy, unfortunately, has lived on in the context of the types of practices that have been adopted in the United States. And our focus has been primarily on practices that have been adopted by the federal government. So we think less and less about this notion that individual whites should feel guilty or responsible. We think that the responsibility resides with the types of policies that have been conducted by the federal government. And so the charge for compensation that we make is a charge that's made directly to the United States government. We don't have the impression that there are any social programs that will bring about an end to the wealth gap. And so it becomes necessary to take direct action.
We will talk about all that and more as we continue, but we have to take a break at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the case being made for reparations for formerly enslaved black people, well, actually their descendants. Dr. William Sandy Darity is with us. He is the Samuel Du Bois Cook Distinguished Professor of Public Policy at Duke University. Kirsten Mullen is a writer, folklorist, museum consultant who works with Sandy on many things, including their book, From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century. And Dr. Benjamin Boswell is with us, preacher, pastor, author, educator, and founder and creator of Confronting Whiteness. Kirsten, Sandy just talked about the spirit of the Confederacy lingering in the United States, in addition to public policy concerns that have held people back. But a lot of people believe that some of these public policy things that have ideologically kept people back have been gotten rid of. In fact, the United States Supreme Court in 2013 in their Shelby County versus Holder case ruled that certain southern states no longer needed the approval of the Department of Justice to change voting rules because the requirement no longer reflected current conditions, meaning that racism is over. That decision applied only to voting, but it seemed to imply that equity had been achieved. They were wrong?
Absolutely. You know, if when you take down the guardrails, you make it impossible to have improvements. You know, if we had this magical you know, equal playing field, then there would be no racial wealth gap. You would have, you know, all of the agencies, all of the commissions, all of the jobs, particularly that were filled by local, county, state, and federal governments, would look like our population. And that's not at all the case. You know, we live in a country where one in four white Americans has wealth of at least $1 million.
Households.
And only 4% of black households can make that claim. And most of them are very recently affluent, you know, individuals who are in the entertainment business or in sports business. It's not a consequence. The wealth that they possess is not a consequence of that generation over generation of wealth that is accumulated. You know, we have never looked at, you know, looked with both eyes at the consequences of having two groups at the end of the Civil War, one that's promised 40-acre land grants, and one that is promised and receives 160-acre land grants. I mean, we're talking about land you could live on, you could subdivide it, you could lease it. You know, any property, resources on the land, timber, water, oil, gas, these are yours, livestock, these are yours to use, to sell, but importantly, to bequeath to your progeny, you know, to will to your children. And this is precisely what did happen. You know, white Americans have had this opportunity, decade over decade, generation over generation, to pass down wealth, and black people have not.
I think was a tragic illusion that was created by the Obama election, where many people interpreted the election of a black president as a signal that racism was over. That's certainly not reflected in the types of data and evidence that we have about inequalities between black and white Americans. And as Kirsten pointed out, those inequalities have largely been generated by public policy that has placed a premium on the well-being of whites to the disadvantage of black Americans.
When you talk about these things to audiences, and maybe some of the people in the audience are skeptical of the need for reparations, do they deny or are they ignorant of some of the things, the disparities that we're talking about? Are they aware of the disparities? Are they aware of the reasons for those disparities? Are they aware of actions and policies that were put in place to ensure those disparities?
I don't think that they're aware of any of the three categories that you described, particularly the outset. First of all, they're not aware of the magnitude of the disparities. People are stunned to learn that as Kirsten pointed out, that one quarter of white households have a net worth in excess of $1 million, but this is only true for 4% of black households. They're also stunned to learn that we have a situation in this country in which people at all ends of the income distribution have sharp racial disparities in wealth. So, for example, the poorest white Americans have an average net worth somewhere in the vicinity of $15,000 to $20,000, while the poorest black Americans, in terms of income, have a net worth that's close to zero. So these disparities exist all along the income spectrum. They also exist along the educational spectrum. So black heads of households with a college degree have a significantly lower level of net worth than white heads of households who finished high school.
Let me just add too, Mike. I think it's the rare person, black or white, who's aware of the magnitude and the extent of destruction of the massacres that took place in
Yes.
this country. I certainly wasn't taught about them in school,
Right.
and I knew about Elaine, Arkansas. I knew about Memphis. I knew about Atlanta, but I knew nothing about Colfax, Louisiana in 1873, or Coushatta in 1874, or that what the reasons those massacres occurred is because white racists did not like the outcome of the elections. And they decided that they were not going to stand for it. And they murdered the
Elected.
legally elected Republicans who gained office. I didn't know that.
That seems to run throughout American history, if recent history is any indication of that. Ben, you're the guy that does the Confronting Whiteness seminars, and I'm just curious. Many people who come to, who don't understand this whole point of view about reparations would point to the end of redlining, which prevented black people from buying homes in white areas. That's gone. The end of other outward and codified indicators of racism, Jim Crow, etc., separate drinking fountains, not being able to go to the same schools, all of that is gone. And they would say, you can get ahead now in America if only you apply yourself. Others would say that even if that it were completely true, the chasm between where that history has left blacks and whites economically requires some sort of aid. Where lies the truth? Is it somewhere in the middle, or is it that latter comment? Everybody needs help.
I think that while I agree that a lot of Americans, and particularly white Americans, are unaware of the serious significance of the disenfranchisement and the gap that exists, the wealth gap, and but I think locked deep in our psyches is a knowledge of this that we are repressing with our white denial. So, for instance, when you break this down and you sort of just apply it a little bit differently, it becomes very, very clear to people what has happened, and it can sometimes change their mind. So, for instance, if we were to take all the families in Myers Park today, I pastored there for almost a decade, and we removed them from all of their homes, we took all of their property, we enslaved them for 250 years of forced labor, we separated their families from each other, and then we freed them with no resources at all, and then subjected them to apartheid, made it impossible for them to get a good job or buy a house, and then subjected them to systematic lynching and the massacres that Kirsten is describing, and then targeted them with heavy policing and mass incarceration, and then finally said to them, what do we owe you? What long-term effects of this experience are you having as a people? I believe the folks from Myers Park would demand reparations, and I think they would demand at least $1 trillion per person. And I think in some ways they would be justified in that request. And so once you put it that way, suddenly it's very clear to folks who are racialized as white, the experience that someone else has had and the long-term impact that would have on them. And they know in their own experience what long-term impact that experience would have on them and their family and their progeny and their children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. And suddenly their minds begin to start to change about how we look at this. And then the questions often go to, and I think it's both positive and negative, how could we possibly repair this? And that's where I think that the work that Kirsten and Sandy have done is so important because they've said, look, here's how we would do it,
You
and have laid it out very clearly.
You are saying all this in the shadow of the Trump administration, which in large part is a response to the Obama administration and some of the so-called wokeism of recent years, which includes the Black Lives Matter movement. And you have Elon Musk, who told recently in the last 2 weeks a right-wing German political party rally that people should not be held accountable for the sins of their fathers or grandfathers. And of course, he was referring to the Holocaust, but we're talking about slavery. And the same thing applies here in many folks' minds. When the topic comes up, Kirsten, someone always says no one alive today had anything to do with slavery. And many people alive today have no connection to slavery, nor do their ancestors. And the other side of that coin is that a lot of people today, a lot of Black people today, have gone well beyond what their ancestors were allowed to do. And therefore, reparations would be unfair to those who would have to foot the bill. What's the answer to that? How do you confront that?
I mean, there are two things to focus on here. You know, this notion that slavery was so long ago, why do we talk about it? And I would say, well, we talk about the founding fathers all the time. You know, they're in every city hall. They're pictures. They're in the libraries. They're in colleges and universities. You know, we can't have one. If we can talk about the founding fathers, we can talk about the founding fathers enslaving Black people. Or let's just get rid of the founding fathers and just only talk about contemporary history. But we don't do that. You know, contemporary matters. But one of the people that we interviewed, whose story is in the book, is a woman named Hortense McClinton. She was UNC Chapel Hill's first Black tenured professor. She is the daughter of a slave, and she is still alive. Hortense McClinton is 107 years old. She lives in the DC area. Her father was an infant when slavery ended, but he was born enslaved. She is one of four Black people that we learned of while we were writing From Here to Equality who were in fact the child of an enslaved person. My grandmother, my mother's mother, is the daughter of an enslaved person. So for many people, it wasn't that long ago. And that's the first point I'd like to make. But the second thing is, we're not just talking about slavery. You know, slavery is a crucible from which all of these ills, all of these maladies sprang. But it's not as if slavery ended and, you know, at the snap of a finger, racism ended, discrimination ended. Suddenly Black people, you know, were able to compete in the same way that Black Americans, white Americans did. You had all of the states across the country, not just the South, implementing Black codes that governed what kinds of things Black people could do. They couldn't own property in many places. They couldn't serve on juries. They couldn't bear witness against white people. They could not take jobs unless white people, you know, approved such. Many of the Black people in the across the South were trapped in these contracts, working as sharecroppers. So it's not as if things just became, you know, the sun rose and things were wonderful for Black people the minute that slavery ended. We're talking about 100 years of white terror campaigns. You know, Jim Crow is a term I wish we could just get rid of. It sounds so, you know, so polite and blah, you know, but in fact, we're talking about a bloody scourge. And you would have had that bloody scourge if white people were not intent on keeping Black people as close to slavery as they possibly could.
Yeah, I'd like to make a couple of points. One is that we don't have an expectation that a reparations plan will be adopted under the current administration, but there was not a realistic prospect of reparations being adopted under either the Obama or the Biden administrations, for that matter. This is a project that will require a struggle from the grassroots level, a groundswell of support that may make this a possibility at some future date. We just want to make sure that we have a plan in place when the opportunity arises to enact a reparation program.
Well, I'm curious how you feel about what's happening in the country. I mentioned that the numbers in the beginning of the program, I mentioned that the numbers of particularly white people who think maybe reparations are a good idea, were improving, have improved over the years.
Actually, they've improved more than the numbers that you used. But the
University of Massachusetts conducted a survey last year that shows slightly decreased support and indicates
from 28% in their 2023 survey to 26% in their 2024 survey, which is actually significantly higher than the 18% figure that you quoted. So actually, it's closer to 30% of white Americans who now support monetary payments as reparations for Black Americans.
I think it's important to look at it a little differently. You're talking about a sevenfold increase from 2000.
Yeah,
that's the point that needs to be made.
Okay. But there is pushback. And Reverend Boswell, not only have you witnessed this, you are kind of a victim of it. I don't want to bring up too much dirty laundry here, but until recently, as you've alluded to, you were the pastor of Myers Park Baptist Church, which is a liberal church in Myers Park here in Charlotte. You were asked to step down after a sermon dealing with what you saw as a call to vigilantism resulting from Donald Trump's a call to vigilance following the inauguration of Donald Trump. But NPR reports that it ran deeper and that it encompassed declining attendance in your time as a senior pastor. And they quote one church member as saying, "I am tired of being indicted because I'm white. I'm tired of being banged over the head every week about immigrants and LGBTQ, and I just want to come to church and be encouraged." And another said, "I was ready for less guilt trip and more love." Clearly, there is resistance. And this one person that referred to being tired of being indicted because of their color, how do you respond to that? How do you get past that feeling of I'm being attacked?
Well, the first thing I would say is that I built Confronting Whiteness as a course to meet people where they are. And you know, this is not just a career of sermons preached from a high pulpit in Myers Park, but a very down-to-earth program of 9 weeks in a small group setting where people are held and supported as they work through looking at their whiteness and the history of whiteness in America through the eyes of Black authors, intellectuals, and creatives in a small group setting surrounded by spiritual practices over 9 weeks together, over 14 hours together in that nine-week period, doing this work in spirituality and formation and also education. That's, you know, people constantly saying, well, how do you meet us where we are on this question of race? Can you meet us where we are? Well, we did. We built a program for you to meet you where you are. And 1,000 people have gone through it and had a tremendous experience where they have had a transformative experience on race. And so I would just invite these folks who are asking questions about being turned off by social justice. Why are you feeling turned off by the suffering of others?
Yeah. There's more to this. We'll get to that. And we also want to get to the how. If this is ever to come to pass, how do you do it? How do you make it fair? How do you make it equitable? How do you afford it? It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Dr. William Sandy Darity, the Samuel Du Bois Cook Distinguished Professor of Public Policy at Duke University, and Kirsten Mullen, writer, folklorist, museum consultant, and more. They're both co-authors of the book From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century. And Dr. Benjamin Boswell is a preacher, pastor, author, educator, and the founder and creator of Confronting Whiteness. Some white folks feel beaten down, I guess would be their words, by the continual harping on what we're talking about this morning. But in the article that NPR wrote about the Reverend Boswell, Sandy, they quote a Black man who told them, as such, he feels beaten down every day. And people don't think about that side of the equation, I suppose. And this sentiment is being echoed among folks who are trying to control what is being taught about our history and how it is being taught in the public schools, because some white parents don't want their children coming home feeling bad about themselves for what people in the past have done who happen to be white. Is there a solution to this?
Well, I think that in the work that Kirsten and I've done, we've de-emphasized this notion that individual white Americans are responsible for the current conditions that exist. There's a whole historical trajectory that's relevant to the present moment. And if any source of responsibility is applicable, it's attributable to the fact that people are ignoring that historical record or trying to distort it. I think that one of the reasons we've had an improvement in the amount of support that white Americans are expressing for reparations is because more and more people have been exposed to a more accurate treatment of the history of this nation. And I think that the pushback that you're describing, particularly people who are complaining about so-called critical race theory, is an attempt to restore a false narrative about America's past leading into its present, particularly a narrative that has been shaped largely by advocates of the lost cause.
Well, the fact that they're talking about critical race theory being taught in our public schools is simply not true. It never was. It was never intended to be. It is a collegiate level theory that is taught in legal classes, not in historical classes. But it's not just the pushback against that. It's the pushback against diversity, equity, and inclusion, which was put in place in part to address what we're talking about this morning. And as one of his first acts, Kirsten, Donald Trump ended diversity, equity, and inclusion programs throughout the federal government and had agencies wipe their websites of any mention of DEI. How do you view that? Does it stem from a belief that, right or wrong, those efforts are no longer needed because merit will always win out, or as an effort to further strengthen white supremacy?
Well, I don't claim to know, you know, what exactly inspired those actions. I can speak to, you know, what appears to be the outcome. You know, I think what is at stake is our own knowledge of and understanding of our history. You know, it's interesting when you think about the case of Japanese Americans who were interned during World War II and who did receive reparations, cash, monetary payments for redress. Their effort included a robust budget for education. It was to be, you know, money spent to develop curriculum from K-12, but also on the college level, to have the transcripts from the hearings that Congress held across the country to talk about the need for reparations for Japanese Americans, but also commissioning plays and musicals and poetry contests. But that education budget was gutted by 90% by President Bill Clinton. And as a result, people like me who grew up in Texas, not only did I not know that Japanese Americans had received cash reparations payments from the federal government, I didn't know they had been interned during World War II. This is what happens when you don't know your history, when you whitewash your history. You know, one of the high schools I went to in Texas had a Daughters of the American Revolution chapter. And so they were very much involved in the business of whitewashing our history with the Confederacy. You know, why is that allowed? You know, I guess I would say, can we have parallel construction? You know, if we're not going to talk about all of our history, then let's not talk about part of it.
Yeah. And an inaccurate interpretation of our history, because some of the people who are pushing for the end of DEI point to Dr. Martin Luther King's famous I Had a Dream speech, dreaming of a day when little black boys and little black girls would be judged not on the color of their skin, but on the content of their character. And they point to that as evidence that he was longing for merit to be recognized over race. But in 1968, just 2 months before his assassination, he advocated for reparations. And he gave this example of why it was deserved, hearkening back to a time just after the government broke its promise to formerly enslaved people of 40 acres and a mule.
At the very same time that America refused to give the Negro any land, through an act of Congress, our government was giving away millions of acres of land. in the West and the Midwest, which meant that it was willing to undergird its white peasants from Europe with an economic floor. But not only did they give the land, they built land-grant colleges with government money to teach them how to farm. Not only that, they provided county agents to further their expertise in farming. Not only that, they provided low interest rates in order that they could mechanize their farms. Not only that, today many of these people are receiving millions of dollars in federal subsidies not to farm, and they are the very people telling the black man that he ought to lift himself by his own bootstraps. Now, this is what we are faced with, and this is the reality. Now, when we come to Washington in this campaign, we are coming to get our check.
We're coming to get our check. And that takes us to what you see, Sandy and Kirsten, as the federal responsibility in all of this. You've said that the U.S. government should pay 10 to 14 to now $16 trillion in reparations because they are financially responsible, because they are culpable for the enslavement of black Americans. They are culpable for legal segregation. And Kirsten, you point out that the federal government was party to both the suppression of the black vote and in some cases the destruction of black people's property, all of which we've talked about. So let's talk about the money, the check, $16 trillion. How would you do that?
So I want to be clear. We are not talking about taking dollars out of white people's pockets and transferring them into black people's pockets, which I think is what many, many people fear would be the consequence of a reparations plan. So in the project that we describe, we actually propose that the federal government will do this without raising taxes. Final chapter of our book, From Here to Equality, sketches a plan of action to do that. The only significant issue with additional federal spending is whether or not you trigger significant inflation. And we discuss ways in which we could mitigate the inflationary effects of such a massive expenditure for the purposes of eliminating racial inequality with respect to wealth in the United States.
Because the government expenditures that were put forth to get us out of the doldrums of the pandemic are what resulted in the inflation that lost Joe Biden the second term in office, or it could be argued that Kamala Harris also lost because of that. So how do you spend $16 trillion, which we don't have because we're already trillions in debt, and so, not raise inflation, from tax money?
I think that there's a mysticism that has arisen that equates household budgeting with the federal government's budgeting practices. And in fact, it is true that state and local governments are constrained by their tax revenues. This is not the case for the federal government. And as I said, you do have the potential problem of substantial inflationary effects. But keep in mind that the response to the Great Recession was substantial federal spending, and it did not have an inflationary effect. So the question that we need to address is, what was different about the pandemic era spending versus the Great Recession response? And I think a lot of that has to do with the breakdown of supply chains as a consequence of the fact that we had to go into shelter during the period of the pandemic. We have to make sure that we do not have those kinds of problems when we introduce another type of large expenditure program like a reparations plan.
So if it's not coming from tax dollars, every dollar that the federal government has is tax dollars or money.
No, this is not true. Or
money that they print.
That's correct. That they create.
Precisely, if you just create more money, that causes problems in the monetary system.
Not in all contexts, particularly if you're in an economy that's highly depressed. Additional government spending by creation of money actually serves as a stimulus for the economy. So it's not inevitable that you produce inflation as a consequence of the creation of new money. You have to address the circumstances and think about how you actually execute your new expenditure policy. We talk about ways in which we could limit the inflationary effects in our book. And there are two ways that we highlight. One way is to spread the $16 trillion expenditure over a series of years. We don't want it to be more than a decade, but you could then be talking about a $1.6 trillion expenditure per annum. The second thing we talk about in the book is the possibility of providing monetary payments in a form other than strictly cash. So we could give people the payments in the form of less liquid assets so that they wouldn't have the capacity to spend it instantly. And that could include annuities, certain types of endowments or trust accounts as other forms in which the payments could be made.
So how would you do it? How would you determine who is in line for these reparations? Because not every Black American is a descendant of a slave. Some of them came from other parts of the world that had no involvement with the period of enslavement in the United States. How would you decide who gets the money?
So we believe that claimants should meet a lineage and a self-identity test. They have to be able to trace at least one, trace their lineage to one ancestor who was enslaved in the United States. And we say that because we're talking about the people who were denied those 40-acre land grants at the end of the Civil War. You know, these are the people who were denied the opportunity to build wealth. And these are also the people who lived through, terror and terror campaigns and legal segregation. So they have to have self-identified as Black, African-American, Afro-American, or Negro at least 12 years prior to the establishment of a reparations commission or program. You know, less than 1% of the country's Black immigrant population entered the country before the 1970s. This would be after the passage of major civil rights legislation. There are some groups, states that are enacting what they're calling reparations, and I put it in air quotes, reparations programs. California would be one of those. And they define the community of eligibility in the following manner, quote, African-American descendants of chattel enslaved person or descendants of a free Black person living in the United States prior to the end of the 19th century. But we think this definition is really problematic because it allows for the possibility of individuals who live and self-identify as white to receive reparations, from the state of California. So we advise against that. But we also say the government should set up an agency that is staffed by professionally trained genealogists who would be available to help individuals establish their claims free of charge.
But the flip side of the coin that I just asked about, where I said not everybody is a descendant of a formerly enslaved person, is the fact that all Black people in America were subjected to the discrimination involved in Jim Crow and up.
That's not true. That's not true.
Really?
No, no. Recent immigrants, Black people from other countries were not allowed in the country unless they were part of the diplomatic corps. Some of them came here illegally. Those are individuals who are deserving of reparations, but not from the U.S. federal government. You know, if you are descended from Haiti, then you make a claim to France. If you are from Jamaica, from Trinidad, from Antigua, you make that claim to the U.K. You know, there's a long list of countries that should
that
pay reparations,
that
owe a debt, but not all of those debts should be paid by the U.S. government. We're talking about those folks who are descended from people who were enslaved here. The histories are very different for Black people from the diaspora. Many of Black people in Jamaica did receive 40-acre land grants.
Or the equivalent,
yeah. Right? So they did not come here.
And actually, that was the basis, the financial basis, for them having the capacity to migrate to the United States, was the wealth that had been generated from the land that they did receive.
I have about a minute left. In the absence of reparations, Ben, are there other options?
Not if you want to close the racial wealth gap, unless you do exactly what we've described and don't call it reparations.
Okay. Well, let me ask all
three. I really
do
think.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I think that white Americans while individually are should not be held responsible financially necessarily for the what the federal government needs to provide in this case, I think are also still spiritually, morally, and emotionally wounded by the history of oppression and injustice towards Black Americans, and therefore need to be a part of advocating for the federal government to engage in reparations in order to heal their psyche and to heal the soul of white America.
Which I guess is the argument for what happened in South Africa with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Dr. William Sandy Darity, Samuel Du Bois Cook, Distinguished Professor of Public Policy at Duke University, Kirsten Mullen, writer, folklorist, museum consultant, two of them the authors of From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century, and Dr. Benjamin Boswell, with the creator of Confronting Whiteness. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.